Hi, this is John Neff, Global Editor-in-Chief of MotorOne.com, and welcome to a new edition of the MotorOne.com US podcast. Today, I'll be discussing this week's big news that Ford is investing $500 million in EV startup Rivian. Joining me this week is MotorOne.com Managing Editor Brandon Turkus. Hey, Brandon.
Hey, John. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. And the other chair is being filled by writer Christopher Smith. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing good, John.
So the big news broke this morning, the morning we're taping the podcast, that Ford has made a $500 million investment in EV startup Rivian. And Brandon, you were online and caught this as it was happening and attended the call and wrote up the report for us. So can you tell us kind of the specifics of the deal that Ford and Rivian have done?
Yeah, so the headlining part of it is that Ford is investing $500 million in Rivian, not General Motors, as rumors had revealed. There was talk that Rivian was chatting with GM, and that clearly fell through. The result of this is going to be immediate in the near term that Ford will build its own model on Rivian's skateboard EV platform. The platform will be built at Rivian's normal Illinois factory, but Ford hasn't said where the final production will be, what segment it will compete in, or anything like that. The deal will also see Joe Heinrichs from Ford on the board of directors for Rivian.
Did they say at all what stake Ford is taking in Rivian? Is it worth? Is it a controlling interest? Is it under 50%? Or did they not mention that?
They didn't mention that explicitly. It certainly doesn't seem like it's a controlling stake. Rivian seems to still have a great deal of autonomy. Someone on the conference call actually asked if Rivian was still consulting with other partners or whether this was exclusive. It's not exclusive, but for now it seems that Rivian is content to be working just with Ford. So we'll see what the next 4 or 5 years brings if we see other automakers getting into bed with Rivian. Volkswagen seems like an obvious one considering their relationship with Ford, but I wouldn't count on hearing, you know, in the next 6 months, Rivian saying, well, we just taken an investment from General Motors or Toyota or Honda or any of Ford's main competitors.
Going into this deal, this investment, what was Ford's current pipeline for pure EVs that they were developing apart from this? And what does Rivian bring to the table in terms of their products?
It's been pretty well publicized that Ford is going to a new platform strategy that sees it have 5 modular architectures, and it will have a architecture purely for battery electric vehicles. We are already going to see a Mustang inspired crossover. There's going to be a zero emissions F-150, and Ford has been pretty public about bringing out new plug-in hybrids. We've seen it with the new Lincoln Aviator and the new Ford Escape, and there's a traditional hybrid in the new Explorer. So the company is firmly on the path of electrification. What the Rivian deal is going to do for them is not really as clear. It seems like there's a bit of overlap, but the company, at least from what we've seen, is promising really, really big numbers for mileage and performance from its platform. So we'll see. Right now, we don't really have an answer to that.
Rivian had already debuted 2 vehicles late last year at the LA Auto Show that were really critically well received. One was a pickup and one was an SUV. So that's where the overlap is. I mean, if Ford's doing a electric F-150 and Rivian is already planning their own electric pickup, those are technically 2 competitors in the same space.
There was a lot of talk about, from Rivian saying, we're marketing towards young, active people, and we want, people with an outdoor spirit. And it sounds almost like, Subaru style, like crunchy granola, outdoorsy mountain climbing stuff. Founder of Rivian, RJ Scaringe, specifically said, that is the segment that we're targeting. We're targeting young, active adults, and gave the impression that Ford is going to be going in a different direction with the vehicle it develops on Rivian's platform.
What are your thoughts on it?
I think it's on the surface, I think it's great for Ford. I think it's too early to tell how good it will really be. Rivian, they really impressed us at the LA Auto Show and last week in New York with their SUV and their pickup. But neither of those vehicles are on sale yet. It's still, you know, we've seen a lot of promises from EV makers, from Faraday Future and Byton and others that haven't really come to fruition. So I think it's still, Rivian is still in the place where they can either go in the direction of Tesla or they could go in the direction of Faraday. And, you know, obviously Ford investing that this amount of money into them shows that there's some confidence in what they're going to do. But I think it's entirely too early to say just how good this will be for Ford. And I also think the amount is low enough that we can't really say this is a huge, massive thing for Ford. This is not a controlling interest. This is not a multi-billion dollar investment. It's $500 million, which is, you know, you don't sneeze at that kind of money, but this is not, it's not a controlling share. They're not taking over Rivian. I think it seems a lot more like an exploratory, almost angel style investment.
Yeah, that's a great point. What about you, Chris? How does this strike your ears?
Well, I mean, let's jump right to the chase. Ford has plans to stop selling sedans and hatchbacks in the United States, and they want to sell trucks and SUVs. So partnering up with an electric company that right now has a pretty good looking truck and an SUV, it seems to make all
really well,
kinds
right?
of basic common sense. And really, in my mind, it shows more direction from Ford in the electric realm than what they've done previously. Last year they dropped $100 million on an electric scooter company, if I remember. Sure. A few years ago they were doing something with like electric bicycles in Europe. It's for a long time it's felt like Ford has really just been grasping at straws trying to figure out how to make up for this immense amount of lost time where they haven't been doing anything in the electric realm. So my mind, on the surface, this seems like a good move for Ford. It all depends on how they shape it and where they take it from here. And I mean, you look at the new Explorer Hybrid, and I say new in quotes. I mean, that was a vehicle really that Ford should have brought out 10 years ago. And other automakers were bringing out your traditional hybrids like that 10 years ago. So they have a lot of ground to make up in a short amount of time. And I think their idea is, let's just buy some companies that have a little bit more expertise maybe in this than we do, and we'll see where it goes. And I'm with Brandon. It's really early to tell right now if this is going to be a really good thing for Ford, but I think it shows that they are at least trying to pick a direction and go there.
Yeah, you know, for my take, I really like what you said about Ford catching up, because when you look at Ford's electrification progress, you know, they were really early with hybrids. You know, I think maybe the Ford Escape was their first hybrid, and that was a long time, like three generations of Escape ago. And then they got into plug-in hybrids, but none of their plug-in hybrids or traditional hybrids ever reached Prius levels of popularity. They always just, you know, sold enough to stick around. And then, of course, Ford had the Focus EV. But that was, you know, a few years ago and in a time where a lot of companies were just putting out EVs with sub 100 mile ranges, and they were basically compliance vehicles to meet regulations in places like California. It really wasn't trying, and Tesla was wiping the floor with them in terms of technology. But in the meantime, you know, GM has come out with the Bolt, and that's a true 200 plus mile range EV. And then you have the luxury automakers like Mercedes and Audi and BMW, all about to hit the market or have hit the market with 200 plus mile range EVs. And yeah, I don't think any of us have seen like what is Ford going to do. They made the announcements, you know, recently about the electric Mustang based or Mustang inspired crossover. And they have talked about the EV F-150, but really all we've seen or heard about are sketches of it or clay models. I mean, we're not seeing that prototypes running around. Like, it's still kind of vaporware-ish, and it seems like they're trading on the excitement about it more than showing us the results. So yeah, I definitely see a need filled here for Ford in terms of catching up with its competitors, because yeah, it wasn't on the same path, like the same hardcore electrification path. At the same time, I look at Rivian, and I was one of the believers late last year around the LA Auto Show when they debuted their truck and SUV. They look great. And of course, you know, they're promising really big ranges, like 300 plus miles, and prices competitive with Teslas. When I step back, they are still part of that group where, yeah, you can make waves by announcing what you hope to do, but until you can show a production-ready, you know, pre-production vehicle that actually does those things, that's one step. And then the second step is building them at scale, which Tesla will tell you is the hardest part. You can create one great vehicle. You can build a pre-production prototype of an awesome vehicle, but to build 5,000 or 10,000 of those a month is a completely different question. So maybe that's where this marriage makes sense. Maybe that's where Rivian gets something, the production expertise of Ford, and Ford gets these kind of great products and great engineering technical know-how.
Yeah, that definitely seems like it's the case, John. Like, it, I think that the big motivator for Rivian, and this was referenced during the conference call, was that the company stands to gain a lot with the knowledge from the broader, you know, more general auto industry and building cars at scale.
Because I used to think that, you know, if Tesla just partnered with a traditional automaker, then all of their production problems would be solved. But Elon Musk made a good point that it's not the same. Building a battery powered vehicle is not the same as building a traditional vehicle. So they wouldn't learn that much from partnering with a Ford or a GM, because when you involve not only the production of the batteries themselves, but, you know, assembling that with the car, it's very different. That sounds correct to me. Like, he didn't go into specifics, even just the batteries. I mean, when you read behind the scenes of what's going on in terms of battery production and having to build gigafactories in order to create the scale needed to make it worth it, but then also sourcing cobalt and the lithium, like, automakers are lining up 20-year contracts to get these mineral rights because they see such a big demand for batteries coming. If you're a company that's not planning for that or finds themselves suddenly behind the eight ball, a move like this is something you got to make. So we heard this was this morning, totally no warning that this was coming. And it made me think instantly about the other mergers, acquisitions, investments that have happened in the auto industry to shake things up. I thought it'd be fun to go around and talk about the ones that stick out most in our mind in the past. So, Chris, let's start with you. What's a merger, acquisition, or investment from the automotive past that is kind of your favorite or most significant to you?
Well, I don't know if this would be my favorite, but significant, and maybe I'm showing my age a little bit here as a child of the 80s. I loved the Mitsubishi Starion, the Dodge Conquest. So I've got to point out the old Diamond Star Motors legacy that actually began with Chrysler picking up a portion of Mitsubishi all the way back in 1970. A lot of people don't realize just how far back that merger went. And that really helped Chrysler through the 70s, just with their badge engineered Mitsubishis that they were bringing over. And we all love the Dodge Challenger of today, but there was that infamous second generation Dodge Challenger there, the late 70s, early 80s.
That I owned one.
you seriously owned one?
In high school, yeah.
We just became best friends, John. I'm a sucker for unloved cars like those. It was a rebadged Mitsubishi Galant. But you know what? It was kind of a cool car. And then through the 80s, you had the Dodge Conquest, the Mitsubishi Starion. Of course, everybody's familiar with Eagle Talon, the Mitsubishi Eclipse, the Mitsubishi 3000 GT, man, the Dodge Stealth.
High watermark.
Those are some iconic cars.
So you guys got some funny high watermarks.
Well, I mean, just go back to that era and those the Eclipse. And I mean, those were great cars. Those were at the time. I mean, you know, and then even the Dodge Stealth and Mitsubishi 3000. Those were great cars too, man. I look at them with rose colored glasses, but
yeah, we both do.
When they come up online, and I see a mint one, I'm like, oh, I'd love to have that sitting in my garage.
The Eclipse, especially. I mean, that kind of became. I hesitate to use the word legendary because it tends to get overused quite a bit. Maybe it's not legendary, but it's certainly an iconic car from the 90s.
If it was good enough for Brian Spillner in Fast and Furious, it's more than good enough for me. And actually, I remember in, I don't know if it was the first or second Gran Turismo, I optioned up, like I modified a Mitsubishi Eclipse to like 2000 horsepower and all this aero. And it just, I didn't even steer it. I just floored it and it bounced off the sides of the track until it won every race.
Now, see, I did the same thing, only it was the 3000 GT. Or in Gran Turismo speak, that was the GTO.
All right. How about you, Brandon? What's what sticks out in your mind?
When we talked about this in the pre-call, I said that I was going to do Daimler Chrysler, and I actually just changed my mind not 5 seconds ago. And I'm going to say BMW and Rover. You look at that. It kind of kept Land Rover alive. It revived Mini. I mean, Mini has became a brand because of that BMW takeover, and we have modern cars because of that. We have modern Minis because of that. And it made, especially in the early generations, the original Cooper was just amazing. It was just a great, amazing piece of design and engineering. And it had just enough BMW-ness that you felt a little bit good driving one. I say this as an owner, I have one sitting in the garage, and yeah, I have it's a first gen. It's an 06. It's supercharged, which is actually going back to Chrysler. There's a Chrysler engine in that car. It's a fantastic little car that showed that you can have this English style and cheekiness and spirit, but good German engineering. And that was happening really before we had German owned Bentleys and German owned Rolls Royces. And it showed that there was still a lot of life in these British brands that could be taken advantage of with the right partner.
Yeah, and I think with Mini, I give Mini a lot of credit that it has survived, if not flourished, in a time when the popularity of small cars just goes up and down with the cost of gas. And right now, you know, the cost of gas is low in the U.S. So, but Mini, people still have an affection for Mini. You know, first-time Mini buyers become second- and third-time Mini buyers, it seems. So they've definitely done, I would say, way more right than wrong with that brand.
Yeah, it's frustrating to see it now because they're definitely in the wrong phase. And the brand is not doing well. Its sales are not doing well. The products are okay, but they kind of lost that character from the first gen cars.
They keep growing. I mean we're on third or fourth generation now of the modern.
Yeah, movie. they're awfully big.
Yeah,
Minis are supposed to be small, so when you create a larger Mini, it sort of defeats the purpose for me. I've driven the larger ones, and it's just like I have no interest in driving the larger ones.
Yeah, I mean we gotta take larger, you know, consider it relatively. Mini Clubman, which is, I think, overall the biggest footprint, is about the size of a Golf. So these are not huge cars. I think the Clubman is longer, like has a bigger footprint, but the Golf or the Countryman is taller. But yeah, the brand is just in an awkward place, and I don't know what the solution to that is. But I'm glad that, you know, BMW stepped in and elevated them to the level that they were at for a long time.
Well, and it's still going. I mean, you know, not all of these mergers and investments and partnerships we talk about are still in effect today. So when you find one that has stood the test of time a little bit, that's impressive.
And I do need to say, Brandon, I mean, astute observation on the BMW Rover thing. There is so much British history that people outside that area don't really know much about. And that merger kind of helped keep that alive.
Even for the Land Rover brand, there was if I recall correctly, there was a time that Range Rovers were carrying BMW engines. And I think that was before they were PAG, but my timeline around then is a little bit fuzzy. But, you know, the BMW did a big service for the British auto industry, keeping those two brands going.
All right. Well, I have a pick as well. I'm going to go back to Chrysler. It's easy to pick Chrysler for all of these, since it is one company that has either bought or been bought by almost every other company. But I'm going to pick from their history, their purchase of Lamborghini back in 1987, kind of for its weirdness and kind of for what both brands got out of it. Lamborghini got money, which, you know, obviously every kind of boutique automaker needs to survive. Not that Lamborghini was at the time floundering. It was kind of at the tail end of the Countach era. But that was really its main car. It had the LM 002, but that wasn't like a volume car. And I believe one other car, I forget which one. What it got from Chrysler, though, was money to develop the Countach successor, which was the Diablo. And I'm a huge Diablo fan. That was like right smack in the era I was growing up. And I was Diablo over F40 at the time. I've kind of changed my tune in the later years. I recognize the F40 for the great car it was. But I loved the Diablo back then. And the fact that it could go like 3 miles per hour faster on a top speed than the F40 was a big point of pride with me and the car I chose to align myself with. So I think it really kind of just propelled Lamborghini to its next step. And fortunately, Lamborghini has kind of kept growing and under Audi's stewardship, it's doing really well. But, you know, it definitely needed the Chrysler ownership to take another step to get there. And if all that we got out of it was the Diablo, I'd be happy with that. Chrysler, though, got a good amount as well. One thing that immediately happened was they debuted this concept car called the Portofino. And it was a super weird, like, design. It looked like a four-door Dodge Stealth, and the Dodge Stealth wasn't out yet. But it was like a four-door Dodge Stealth. All four doors were Lamborghini scissor doors, but like opening up in a suicide fashion. And the engine was mid-mounted, so it was behind the seats of a four-door. I would put the styling of it as it's got like a Dodge Stealth front end, but this was the first example of cab-forward design that really became a marketing catchphrase for Chrysler going forward. And, you know, we get the Dodge Intrepid from that, and the Chrysler 300, and a whole bunch of cars that adopted that. And then, of course, we got the Dodge Stealth itself, which I think, like I said, I look fondly back on that car. I don't know really how it came to an end. I know sales started to kind of plummet after the initial success of the Diablo. Chrysler kind of, instead of Lamborghini making money, it started siphoning money away from Chrysler, who I'm sure couldn't afford it at the time. And Chrysler decided to dump it pretty quick, and that era ended. But yeah, not before they both affected each other. And I think, you know, two brands with great histories kind of just, you know, meeting for a little bit and then parting again. Definitely one of my favorite investments / merger / acquisitions of all time.
I remember that concept car, John. And to add to that, I also have a very clear memory. I was still pretty young at this point. I have a very clear memory of a Chrysler commercial, and this must have been around 1990 or so, because it was, they were boasting their performance pedigree, and I remember seeing there was the Dodge Spirit RT in there, if you remember that that crazy car, and they capped off the commercial with the Lamborghini Countach. I can't remember, it might have been earlier than 89 90. It all kind of fades together back then, but I have very clear memories of that commercial. And I mean, it's the fact that it stuck with me all these years is, I think, a testament to that partnership at that time. Like you just said, a couple companies meeting in the night for just a little bit, and you know what? They did some good stuff.
The Viper was being developed at the same time as a concept car. And to think that the same company at the same time was developing the Diablo and the Viper is really cool. And I've read that the Viper designer got to give some input to Lamborghini and some design decisions. I'd probably say Lamborghini is doing better right now than the Chrysler, at least the Chrysler brand. Chrysler as a whole is doing really well, but that's more because of Jeep than anything else.
Yeah, the Chrysler brand is kind of a shell of what it once was.
it's like I said, it's basically Jeep. They just still call it Chrysler in public. We'd love to hear from everybody what you think about not only the Ford investing in Rivian, but our choices for the coolest or most significant investments, mergers, acquisitions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at MotorOneCom, where this discussion will continue. And of course, it's on our website, MotorOne.com, where you can find all three of us and the rest of the editors and writers in the comments. So coming up, we'll find out what we've all been driving this week. Before the break, though, a reminder that if you are listening to this online, you can also get our show on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So why not hit the subscribe button now so you don't miss our show next week. During this part of the show, we talk about what cars we're driving this week. And today we're going to start with Brandon. Brandon, what are you driving this week?
So I've spent the last week with the Subaru Crosstrek plug-in hybrid. And this is the new model. This is not the old Crosstrek with the standard hybrid engine. This is a plug-in model. It'll do 17 miles to a charge. And it recharges from a wall outlet in about 5 hours, which is really good for the amount of mileage that you get. It's a usable amount of time. So if you're the type of person that, even if you have a longer commute to work, if you have a way of charging up while you're there, you can conceivably cut gas out of the equation for the most part. I've really enjoyed my time with this car. I'm in a bit of a unique situation that I work from home and I rarely have to travel very far. So it's been very easy for me to keep it charged up and take advantage of the electric range. I'm averaging about 45 miles to the gallon right now. The combined city figure is around 35, I think. So it's doing really, really well on fuel. It's very comfortable to drive, just like the standard Crosstrek.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the powertrain for the Subaru Crosstrek plug-in hybrid comes from the Toyota Prius Prime, the plug-in hybrid version of the Prius. It's a product of their partnership on some hybrid stuff.
Yeah, there are bits and pieces that are shared between them. It's not a straight one-for-one thing. As Clint Simone covered in Motor One's first drive of the Crosstrek plug-in, there's some parts commonality, but not quite as much as you might think. It's still got a lot of Subaru character to it. It drives like a Subaru. It does not remind me of a Toyota at all.
I will say I like the idea of a plug-in hybrid that is skews a little bit more on the side of like adventure traveling than most other plug-in hybrids that are like, you know, either urban vehicles or they're just not like adventure vehicles, not like rough and tumble kind of stuff. The Crosstrek does have, you know, a raised ground clearance. It can go off road a little bit. So that's cool. And it's all wheel drive. Not a lot of plug-in hybrids are all wheel drive.
Right. And it's always all wheel drive. It's not, you know, there's not a differential suddenly switching around and saying, ta-da, I'm no longer front wheel drive. I'm all wheel drive. It's always there, all wheel drive. It does have that kind of off-road ability. There's an X mode, I believe it's called, for going off on the trails. And I didn't really use that. It's nice to have that ability. I don't think most consumers are going to use it as much as Subaru wants to market and say that people will use it. My main concern with it, especially for the people that would want to go off-road and want to be in the outdoors and kind of, you know, really feed into that Subaru aesthetic and character, is that the battery pack, instead of putting it in the floor like it is for most crossovers, it's in the trunk and it takes up a substantial amount of cargo space. You're not going to put a golden retriever in the back of this car. He will not be very happy with you. So this is easily the least dog-friendly Subaru there is. It beyond taking up space in the cargo hold, one of the things that you might not necessarily think about is that because of where the battery pack is at, right on the bottom of the trunk, it increases the liftover height by probably at least 8 inches to a foot. It's a big difference in how much you have to lift things over the bumper and over the battery pack to get it into the cargo hold.
I'll give it props for being probably the least expensive all-wheel drive option for a plug-in hybrid, because I bet once you go above that, you're looking at luxury SUVs that are plug-in hybrids from BMW, Mercedes, Range Rover. You know, there's not really any, not that I can think of, all-wheel drive in the, like the $30,000 range.
This car starts at $35,000. Mine is the only option package, which is a sunroof and heated seats and navigation. And it rings up at about $38,000. That's before a $4,500 federal income tax credit. So that softens the blow a little bit.
I think, though, that 17 miles of range just is not enough in a plug-in hybrid. I think 30 should be the minimum of that. To me, that's the minimum of practical usability.
That is a very valid point. And like I said, I've been in the unique case where I can keep it charged all the time. I don't necessarily need that range, but even when I do need to go the entire way, I stretch the charge out to about 23 miles over Easter weekend. And so I think there's a little bit of sandbagging here because I was not babying it. I was not driving it conservatively. I was driving it the same way I would drive any plug-in hybrid. And I made it, you know, up to my parents' house and about a mile or two back before the gas engine kicked in. And I looked it up. It's 22, 23 miles. So there's definitely, I think there's a little bit of sandbagging going on in that total number. I think it might be a little bit conservative.
That's good to hear. It's more than expected. But Chris, you're joining us from South Dakota. Is there anywhere that you drive that is less than 17 miles away from you?
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm in Western South Dakota. I'm in Rapid City. So I'm just a couple miles from downtown, but honestly, once you get out of Rapid City, yeah, it's pretty empty.
Oh, would a plug-in hybrid with 17 miles, would that make sense to you at all? I mean, maybe one with 30 miles wouldn't make sense to you either, but
you know, I mean, if you lived in the city and were working in the city here, I mean, yeah, it would make sense. But outside of that, I mean, yeah, it's I think Sioux Falls is probably the next largest city outside of Rapid City. That's 4 hours away. Denver is 6.5 hours.
But there is two things that you have to keep in mind here, John. And the first is the price. It's $35,000. It's not, and there's a $4,500 tax credit. So that's not crazy for what you're getting. And it's always on all-wheel drive. The reason that it doesn't have more mileage is because you're giving up that range for all-wheel drive.
I would say the all-wheel drive is its selling point. I would say its price is not, because you can get an all-electric Bolt with 240 miles of range for that price. You could even look, well, it would cost more in the end, but you could look at a Tesla Model 3 for that if you wanted. When I look at plug-in hybrid vehicles, and maybe other people are different, I want the all-electric range to be able to cover 90%+ of my driving. Like I want it to cover my daily routine driving completely. And then I want the gas engine there to be able to go on the longer trips, you know, that are outside of my daily routine. And I just don't think so. For me, and I live in a suburb where, you know, I don't take that long a trip for doing errands and things, but on a Saturday, driving around doing errands, I don't think 17 miles would do it, but 30 would. So, yeah, I'm on the fence with the Crosstrek. I think, like I said, having the all-wheel drive is a selling point for sure. And maybe they can bank on that and sell a few. But, you know, compared to almost all other plug-in hybrids, 17 miles is on the very short end of that spectrum. All right, let's move on to Chris. Chris, what are you driving this week?
Well, obviously in Western South Dakota, I'm not in the media fleet. So we're going to look at the secondhand market at my 2004 Mazda 6S 5-door hatchback, which will have to be pried from my cold, dead hands. I know, John, you wanted me to talk about the Mustang. Maybe we can do that next time.
No. I want to talk about the 6 because it's such a unique vehicle. And I don't think many people remember that Mazda sold a 4-door hatchback version of the 6 back in those days.
Right. And it goes back to Americans just believing that hatchbacks must be tiny little cheap runabout cars, and obviously that's changing now a little bit as we're seeing higher end automakers creating their liftbacks. They're still not calling them hatchbacks. It's really a shame because this Mazda, I sought it out specifically because I wanted that extra practicality, and I always liked the look of the 6 as a sedan. Of course, the bones are Ford Fusion, and honestly, I've driven the Fusion of the same era. And I really hated that car, and the 6 just feels completely different. It has that zoom zoominess that Mazda likes to inject into the cars. And as far as practicality goes, I've literally hauled a washing machine in this car. This isn't a wagon. This is the, you know, the four-door sedan with, I hauled a washing machine in the car. I've hauled a desk in the car with the hatch, with everything closed. The practicality is insane.
Wow. I thought you meant with the hatch open.
No, the hatch was completely closed. Everything is completely closed inside. The space,
what's the engine in it?
It's the 3-liter 24 valve V6. I believe it was rated at 220 horse back in the day, somewhere around there. But then Mazda kind of rounded that number down a little bit in later years. I mean, it's enough to be entertaining. I'm not going to go winning any stoplight battles, but I mean, it has plenty of power to be entertaining. The handling continues to surprise me, and I think it looks great. It's kind of an unsung car. I try to recommend that car as much as I can, just because if you want something that actually looks good, that's fun to drive, that has some legitimate cargo capacity, there are very few cars out there that can match up to that.
And you're not going to see a million of them out there.
No, you really don't.
There are two things about that generation of six that are really fantastic. I love them, and I remember them from my brief time driving that first gen car. The first is that the liftback model gets a rear windshield wiper, correct?
Yes.
Every normal car should have that. Every single one, as standard. I loved that was on there. And also, that does yours have the manual transmission?
Unfortunately, no. It's the automatic, which my wife loves. And I mean, honestly, it's the 5-speed automatic. I believe they went to the 6-speed automatic in 2005. And really, the 6-speed automatic would be a little bit better on the car. The 5-speed has just some odd gaps in it. But I mean, the shifting is crisp. It does have the manual mode where if I want to, I can just let it bounce off the rev limiter all day long. I won't automatically shift. Not that I do that on purpose, but every now and again, if I want to get a good launch in first gear, first gear just goes way too quickly, and it'll bounce off the limiter. A friend of mine had a 5-speed, and it's a fun car to roll the gears on. The engine, that V6, even though it's the 3-liter V6, it's kind of down on torque. So with the automatic, I almost liken it to a turbo car with a little bit of turbo lag right off the beginning. It could be a little unnerving at first, but then once it gets up on cam, it just kind of takes off.
Very nice. Well, I always leave it to you to find cars that other people have forgotten about, or you know, trims that time has forgot. So great choice, and I'm glad it's in your garage. As for me, I've driven two cars this week, and it seems like this is our week of electrification, because both of the cars I've driven are electric to some degree. So for most of the week, I was driving a Range Rover Sport plug-in hybrid. I've driven the regular Range Rover, a diesel version, and I really love this generation of the Range Rovers. I had some trouble with this plug-in hybrid version of the Range Rover Sport. Particularly, I couldn't get it to charge at my house. I was just trying to charge it through a regular 110 outlet, and it was tripping my GFCI plug, and I just couldn't get it to charge. So I pretty much had to treat it like a normal hybrid. And to be honest, without that, the 30 miles of range it provides for EV, I didn't really like driving it in regular traditional hybrid mode the whole time. I mean, if I were going to be driving it like that, I'd rather have the diesel or one of the gas engines. If I did have the electric range to play with and recharge every night, I think I would have liked it more. And then today, I am, rather than calling you from my home office in Cleveland, I'm down at Motor One HQ in Miami. And we've got a Chevy Bolt this week. So I took that to lunch with senior editor Jeff Perez. And that's my first time driving a Chevy Bolt. It was about what I expected, but I'm always amazed by pure electrics and kind of the nature of them, you know, with the all the weight being down at the bottom of the car because of the batteries. Just the nature of their acceleration, even though the Bolt is not a hot rod like a Model 3 or a Model S, it's still very quick. And the Bolt definitely feels kind of like an economy hatchback. You know, you know, it's definitely not like a Tesla or any of the German cars in terms of their build quality or anything like that. But man, I just love the nature of electric cars. And so I had a blast driving to get some hot dogs at lunch, accelerating too hard, turning too fast. And so I have a pretty good outlook for the next 10 years with all of this electrification happening and all the news that's being made, like this week about Rivian and Ford. I'm excited for the next chapter. I don't bemoan the demise of the gas engine, because I don't think it is going to demise. I think there's a long time to go for electric cars to command significant chunks of market share. And I just love the way things are going. I think it's an exciting evolution and changeover in the market that we get to watch. Have you guys driven the Bolt?
I adore the Bolt, actually. I think it's, first of all, full disclosure, I am from the town where the Bolt is built. I used to drive by the factory regularly. So by the Bolt, it's good for my hometown. I like it. but no, it drives really, really well. It's, you know, it is kind of an economy hatchback, but it's one of those EVs that it's easy to forget that you're driving an electric car.
I've not driven the Bolt, but I'm with you, John, on the whole electrification thing. Back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when the automobile was first coming about, you absolutely know there was somebody saying that horses were far superior, that these new fangled mechanical horses just didn't have the same feel. They didn't have the same passion. And it's called progress. And I love a roaring gas engine as much as anybody, but I also love the immediacy of an electric motor. And once you have a proper ride in a high performance electric car and you just feel that initial kick, it's something that you never forget. So I'm very much looking forward to the future of electrification.
So that reminds me, and this is going to be a tangent, a very typical John Neff tangent, it reminds me of the movie Seabiscuit, where the lead character, the guy who buys Seabiscuit, originally was into horses. Then he saw cars, and he, you know, predicted that cars would be the next big thing, and he invested a bunch of money into them, and he had a car dealership, and that's how he made all his money. And then his son was out driving his truck and drove it off a cliff by accident and died. And then he all of a sudden couldn't look at another car. He wheeled all the cars out of his barn and filled it all with horses again, including Seabiscuit. But it just reminded me of you know, that period where horses were the big thing. And it took a lot of people believing in something else to supplant that and show them that, you know, this is progress. This is better than the thing that's been around. And I agree. I think the same thing is happening with electric vehicles. And it's still pretty early, but the technology is advancing so fast, with longer ranges, better charging infrastructure, lower prices, all of that. And there's still a lot of hurdles to go. But you know, I think nobody's asking for it to happen overnight. And it's certainly happening at a pace I'm okay with. You know, and like I said, I don't think gas engines or gas powered vehicles are going anywhere anytime soon. And even they're advancing as well. I mean, just the, you know, average fuel economy of brands.
And in fact, horses now, and I think it was, I think it was James May that did something a while ago, or maybe it was Leno?
It was Leno on Top Gear.
That's right.
In a star in a reasonably priced car segment.
Yes. Yes. Where he said, you know what, the way things are going now, it could free up the gas engine to be more of a pleasure vehicle while we have electric or autonomous vehicles that we use for the daily grind. And there's always going to be passion in automobiles, as long as there are things rolling on four wheels.
Yeah, and the funny thing, though, is I think that electric motors, electric you know, powertrains actually lend themselves so well to the part of automotive enthusiasm that we like. I mean, they are better performance machines than gas-powered cars. I mean, right now we're waiting for the Volkswagen IDR that has already broken records around the world to break the lap record at the Nürburgring, because you know, an electric powered race car can pretty much do everything a gas powered one can, but better. So we'll, and that should be happening in I think a few weeks or so. That brings us to the end of our podcast. You can follow Brandon on Twitter at Brandon Turkus, and you can follow Chris at CH Writing, and you can follow me on Twitter at John_M_Neff. I want to thank you two for being here with me on the podcast this week.
Always a pleasure.
It was a good time as usual.
And then thank all of you out there for listening, and we'll see you next week.